Good morning, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We begin our conversation today about what's the terrorist attacks happening throughout Ramadan. Today is Eid. Many of the people who were killed in Baghdad in that bombing, 250 people of the latest count I've seen, at least 175 wounded, maybe more, were out mostly shopping to celebrate Eid on the day after the end of Ramadan. And it was interesting. I wrote to some people this morning, friends of mine in Iraq and my Iraqi friends here in America and in Britain, and wrote to them, you know, we going back and forth about where are the candlelight celebrations for the Iraqi dead? Where are the people standing in the street? Where are the buildings bathed in Iraqi flags? And just this morning, one of them just a moment ago emailed me before he went on the air to say that Facebook now finally has an Iraqi flag that you can put on your Facebook page. They did that this morning. But it does beg the question of why we ignore the killings, the 10,000 people in Iraq who have been killed over the last 3 years, if my account is right, from different terrorist attacks from many sides within that country. The numbers of people that have been killed throughout the world. And we know that much of what we see is a direct result of our intervention in the Arab and the Islamic world. But it's not just the war in Iraq. This goes back to Afghanistan and Ronald Reagan and deeper. And the question is, what is our response? That is the reality we are faced with, and what do we do? We are honored once again to have with us Rami Khoury. Rami Khoury is Senior Policy Public Policy Fellow at the Issam Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut, a syndicated columnist for Agence Globale Syndicate and USA and Daily Star in Beirut, and a non-resident senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School joining us from Beirut. Rami, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Karim Samara is here. He's a British Palestinian musician and founding member of Artists for Palestine UK and London Palestine Action. He collaborates with folks here in Baltimore. He's visiting now, blending American Arabic protest music. And Phyllis Bennis joins us as well. She's director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And Phyllis, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
And you all can call in with your comments at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. And Rami, let me begin with you. You're joining us from Beirut, and I know you'll have about a half an hour, so I want to get right at your question immediately. Let me start by saying that you wrote on Elie Wiesel, I thought was one of the most profound pieces I've read about him, a man I've met once who I had a great deal of fondness for his thinking, and you pointed out his shortcoming around Palestinians, which I thought was a very balanced, beautiful piece, and I appreciate what you wrote there, by the way.
Thank you.
So when you look at that, given the world we are faced with now, and there were also killings in Lebanon that we didn't talk much about recently as well, and terrorist attacks. I mean, how do you see the world proceeding at this moment in response to all of this?
I think what you can see is a series of patterns actually all over the world in different dimensions. You see large populist rebellions, disenchantment, fear, despair, even humiliation among millions and millions of people, ordinary working people, lower-income people, people who are having trouble meeting their basic family needs. And many of these people are rebelling in different ways in countries where they have electoral possibilities to vote for candidates, progressive candidates. They do that. In other countries where they don't have that electoral opportunity, they get involved in mass popular protests and street demonstrations. Other places, people just leave. They immigrate if they can. And in other places, they just join any group that will help them stay alive, even if it includes joining a militia or a group like ISIS that pays them $400 a month. So at one level, there seems to be a serious fragility in many of the structures of statehood and the neoliberal modern economies that we have all over the world. And part of that is leading to the to the fragility or even disintegration that's leading to violence in many places. But the real problem is the heart of the problems that we see with bombings and ISIS and Gaza is really in the heart of the Arab world. There's been a problem inside the Arab world for the last 50, 60 years, which is dysfunctional statehood, corrupt and incompetent government, people exploiting each other, foreign interference militarily. The Americans have been fighting for about 25 years in the Middle East and South Asia without really much success. The terrorist groups have been expanding as the American military involvement expands over the last quarter century. Israeli colonization and settlements and expansion, and that has had its own impact. So there's a series of problems inside the Middle East that have basically seen the existing structures of governance fail in most cases, not every case, and therefore there's been this kind of a chaotic situation where all kinds of different groups, tribal groups, family groups, ethnic groups, religious groups, militant groups, take over and take care of themselves because the central government isn't able to take care of them. ISIS is just the last and worst manifestation of this kind of fragmentation and collapse of coherent statehood. The real trouble is not that ISIS is such a violent group. It is. The real trouble is that ISIS reflects a much wider base of dysfunction, human despair, that probably touches the lives of maybe 40, 50 million people across the entire Middle East. And that's the really scary thing, that when ISIS is defeated, there are still going to be tens of millions, if not maybe 100 or more million people who can't feed their kids, have no chance of a normal life. And these people are going to do anything they can to save themselves, including criminal activity. So we have a problem now that's been developing over the last 50, 60 years, and we're just now seeing the real the fruits of it or the consequences of it. And it's not going to be fixed quickly or easily or by military force. And this is the real challenge that all of us face.
So Phyllis, I mean, I really do appreciate Rami Khoury's analysis here, Phyllis, and I think that if we have that perspective that what we're seeing now in Baghdad, in Yemen, in Bangladesh, around the world, is a result of, as Rami just said, of 50, 60 years of absolute dysfunction and of policies of the West towards the Arab and Islamic world, that combination, I think that's why people had such a difficult time wrestling with what is our response? What is a world response?
Right. This is a huge challenge, and I agree. Rami's very wide-ranging assessment, I think, is right on the money. I think that when we look at what the response should be, yes, there are particularities that go to issues of timing. All of this recent spate of attacks that are allegedly part of ISIS or inspired by ISIS or committed by ISIS. We don't have details on some of them yet. But they all are following the loss of a significant piece of territory and population that was once under ISIS control. This happened last fall as well when ISIS lost control of Ramadi. The one result was the attacks in Paris just a couple of weeks later. This time around, it was the loss of Fallujah. And what followed very shortly after was a set of attacks in the region that killed just devastating numbers of people. So that's important to recognize because it goes to the immediacy of the failure of U.S. policy to respond to ISIS as if it was carrying out the D-Day attacks on an occupying country or something. You know, this is not going to work. And it seems to me that when we look at, well, what do we do? The challenge is, number one, to first acknowledge that what we're doing has failed and indeed has made things worse. So the first lesson is the lesson that every medical student learns on her first day in medical school. First, do no harm, the Hippocratic Oath. Whatever else you do, don't make it worse. If your goal, as you claim, is to stop the killing of people in the war that ISIS is waging, don't kill more people claiming to be ending the war against ISIS. So this is one of the hardest things, is to acknowledge that the military force strategy doesn't work. So what might work? Well, it's going to be a whole host of things. As Rami indicates, This is a long-standing problem. I would put the focus perhaps in greater percentages, if you will, on the question of outside intervention, the role of the U.S. military interventions over the last quarter century, the impact of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, U.S. backing of the Israeli colonization project for 60 years. All of that has had these enormous impacts. So what do? We start to try to reverse the conditions that give rise to a situation where, as terrible as ISIS is, many people are starting to look to them as the lesser danger. They look to them not because, oh, I like what they're doing, beheading people and forcing this incredibly extremist, violent version of Islam down the throats of everybody under their control. But despite that, that's what's so dangerous here. Despite how dangerous and how horrific it is for people living under ISIS control, for many, that is seen as less of a problem than the problem of being, quote, liberated by the corrupt Iraqi government or the violent Shia-dominated militias that fight alongside the government. There was a poll just about 2 weeks ago conducted in Mosul, second largest city in Iraq, the city that has been under ISIS control for 2 years now and is widely seen as the next target of a U.S. bombing campaign to, quote, liberate it. 76% of the population said, we don't want to be liberated by these Shia militia. We would rather the situation remain as it is, as bad as it is. And that's a devastating statement about the impact of the so-called global war on terror orchestrated militarily by the United States on the people in whose name it's being fought. We don't ever ask people, do you want us to come liberate you with our bombs and on the backs of our tanks? If we did, there might be a very different answer than the assumption that because the situation now is indeed so horrific, that somehow the military response is going to be welcomed. This is the old line of the Bush administration about Iraq, that we'll be welcomed with rice and flowers in the street. We don't need a plan for what to do after the invasion and occupation, after we overthrow Saddam Hussein, because the Iraqi people will be so grateful, they'll pour into the streets, they'll immediately begin to produce more oil, they'll use all that oil to pay us back for whatever it costs, and they will take over their country and all will be roses and flowers. It just doesn't work that way. And until we acknowledge that military efforts to go after terrorism don't work, because you can't bomb terrorism. You can only bomb people. You can bomb cities. That creates more terrorism, not less. And it comes back to the immediacy, the correlation of dates. When ISIS loses territory and loses control of parts of the population of their so-called caliphate, they don't simply disappear. They turn to their earlier iteration of what their strategy was, which was old-fashioned terrorism against civilian targets in Iraq, in Istanbul, in Cameroon, to the degree that there's a link with Boko Haram, in all these places, in Paris, perhaps in San Bernardino. That's what we're going to see as they lose more territory. This is a game of whack-a-mole, and the people who are being the most hurt by it are the people in whose name the U.S. claims it is doing the fighting.
So let me just ask this quick question. And Rami, I know you have to go in 10 minutes. Let me just come back to you before I turn to my two studio guests who are holding, standing by to jump in the conversation as well. So in this kind of many-sided conflict that has been created throughout the Middle East and the Islamic world, you can watch Turkey and see how the Turks who really wanted to blame this bombing in many ways on the PKK, on the Kurdish resistance in Turkey, and also have had this kind of weird relationship with ISIS and kind of ignoring it in many ways, and then looking at the battles the Kurds are doing at the behest of Americans in the West in their battle against ISIS and in some ways against the Iraqi government. I mean, so there's no real unity here in any of this, but can a completely non-military response, and I don't even know how you would define what that military response would be, to Islamic State? I mean, can there be anything but some kind of military response? Some people would argue, given is an entity that is not here to negotiate with anybody.
Well, I would say that you need to have some kind of police action or military response that is legitimate and within the rule of international law, and that is certainly allowed by the existing rules, especially if you go through the Security Council. So you need some military response to achieve some limited aims, such as the U.S. did in northern Iraq to stop the spread of Islamic State in the summer of 2014, which, you know, worked to a very limited extent. But continuing to use military means as the main force or the main means of action doesn't work. It just breeds greater reactions and resistance and resentment. The fascinating thing and important thing about ISIS is I've been doing research for the last year or so trying to identify the many reasons why people across the Arab world and the whole world, but mostly the Arab world, because I still see ISIS as the heart of it is an Arab problem. Why so many people, for so many different reasons, like it or support it or hate it or don't fight it when it comes to them? And what's troubling is that I've identified around 95 different reasons, distinct different reasons, why different people support or like ISIS, or they approve of what it does or what it aims for, which is this perfect Islamic society, as they claim. And this is what is troubling, is that there can't be just one strategy. But many different reasons why ISIS exists respond to the whole range of dysfunctions, calamities, despair, unmet needs, exploited people, abuse of power, all the problems across the Arab world and other parts of the Middle East and the region. And these are the issues that need to be addressed with political reform, economic justice, security reform, all kinds of political actions by the local governments as well as by foreign governments. And when we talk about foreign governments, by the way, we're not now just talking about the U.S. and England and France and Israel. We're now also talking about Turkey, Iran, Russia, who are directly involved in the fighting in Syria, for instance, and Saudi Arabia is there. So there's a lot of foreign governments now who are using military action inside Arab countries to make the situation even worse. Historically, it was the Western countries and Israel that were the biggest problem from our perspective. So this is why it's so difficult that, you know, beating ISIS, defeating ISIS, will happen when we address the underlying drivers that cause it to come to life and to persist. And this is going to be increasingly difficult now, because when it's defeated in Raqqa and in Mosul and Fallujah already, it's been defeated. When they don't have one clear territorial base, they're going to disperse. They're already dispersing, and the bombings we're seeing now are a sign of this. Both, some of them are centrally dictated, it seems, and others are just actions that individuals take around the world, and they claim that they're following ISIS. So what you're getting is a kind of dispersed cellular system that is loosely connected, what some people have called a ghost caliphate or a terrorist diaspora, what I call a gangster jihadi cult. There's many different words that people use to describe a situation where thousands and thousands of people all over the world have the same feelings and take actions, military, terrorist, criminal actions, and they're not necessarily all connected or managed by a central command. And this is much, much more difficult to defeat than what we have now. So moving towards defeating ISIS means moving towards reforming, significantly, seriously reforming the socio-political economic structures of the Arab world and some other countries. And that means changing foreign policies of the U.S., of Israel, of Russia, of Iran, and other countries. This is not going to happen quickly, but it'll have to happen someday. I mean, if you can change South Africa, if you can change Northern Ireland over time, then certainly we can make these kinds of changes in our countries, but we don't have yet the leadership or the popular movements that have been able to bring this about.
So thank you, Rami. And I want to turn just to my studio guest here for a moment before we go to break. And Dr. Max Hilaire is here from Morgan State University, chair of the Political Science Department, and Kareem Samara joining us from Britain, where he's a British-Palestinian musician and activist. And I mean, just very quickly, Kareem, before we go to break, I'm very curious when I think about the Palestinian Muslim Arab diaspora throughout the world, young activists like you. Mm. What's your response to all this is? I mean, because you're in the middle of the struggle around Palestine in London, in Britain, in Europe, something you're very passionate about. But also there's a larger question because, I mean, we were just talking about we're at Eid and you took the month of Ramadan to fast,
yeah.
Right? And so it's that these worlds that come together, especially for your community.
Yeah.
I'm just curious how you and your comrades respond to this.
I was just talking with someone yesterday how it's hard to imagine the world before 9/11 and how things were easy in a day-to-day life. Rather than having to spend every day since that, having to justify who you are and your belief, right? With Palestine, linking into this was very, very simple for myself personally, was because of the refugee, Palestinian refugee diaspora in Yarmouk in Syria, where my friends are.
That's where your family was?
No, my friends. Friends of mine. And
oh, that's right.
Comrades,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And a lot of friends of the people actually that I make music with in Baltimore, also in Yarmouk. It's like the largest Palestinian refugee camp in the Arab world. It's like a district rather than even a camp. And that instantly became a conversation about ISIS. We knew about ISIS before most people did. Well, if you were in the Arab world and following the things that are happening, like in Fallujah, you knew about an uprising of a Sunni militia against the corrupt Shia government, so you heard about these things happening at the time. But then when it came to Syria, the camp was instantly divided by the attempted occupation forces of that camp within, like, an internal civil war of a civil war. And very quickly the camp was shut off on one side by ISIS, shut off on one side by the Assad regime, shut off on another side by a Palestinian group loyal to Assad, for example. So you have it instantly links. And then also in London, one of the problems was that you deal with, I guess in a less extreme way, the forces that create somebody loyal to a gang like ISIS. And I just, as soon as Rami said gangster, I'd just literally written gang, because that's exactly what they are. I'm from an area in London where many people go to fight for ISIS. And there is, you would think there was no reason to do it. You live in a democracy or a flawed democracy of sorts, right? you have freedoms, you have, you may be hard done by, but you're probably a lot better than off than you, if you're an immigrant, for example, or sons and daughters of immigrants. It's about disenfranchised youth. There's so many factions that come together, but there are a lot of people that come, a lot of the Jihadi John, you know, all of these kinds of figures are from London and are from the UK. How do you even begin to switch your focus from activism on Palestine when you're fighting for free Palestine against oppression, and suddenly the people that could even be on your side are going fighting for ISIS to have guns and have money and to be big macho men. But at the same time, ISIS is against, like, for example, a Palestinian state, right? So it just all came together. And I think that the...
Take my picture.
Yeah, I think that when you're... I think you really have to just be extremely, extremely open to listening to the people on the ground when you're dealing with any of this from a Western perspective, even as... If you want to identify yourself as an Arab or as a Muslim or whatever, I mean, it comes down to the wide scope of people's experiences.
We have to take a very quick break. I'm going to come right back to Dr. Max Allaire, who's joined us now in studio, and also to Phyllis Bennis. I want to thank Rami Khoury for joining us from Beirut. Rami, it's always an honor to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back with Rami Khoury again another day as well, since he has to head leave. But we will come back with Dr. Max Allaire, Kareem Samara, Phyllis Bennis, and you at 410-319-8888. Do join us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. We are here with Dr. Max Hilaire, Chair of Political Science at Morgan State University, Phyllis Bennis, Director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, Karim Samara, a British-Palestinian musician and activist who is in Baltimore doing his musical work. And you all at 410-319-8888. Come to those calls in a minute. But let me turn to Max Hilaire. We haven't heard had a chance to hear from you yet, and I just you've heard this kind of the breadth of the problem that you already know about, and I was thinking what Phyllis was saying and about what Rami was saying, just about who ISIS is and why it's so difficult to have the response to ISIS, and so your perspective.
Thank you, Mike, for inviting me, and I think there's quite a topical issue, and we probably need more of a discourse on this, not just in Baltimore, Maryland, but globally. I think what resonates with all peoples all over the world is the senselessness of this indiscriminate violence against innocent civilians, people who, whether it's in Paris or Orlando or in Dhaka, Bangladesh, or even in Iraq, where people are basically going to the market, or in Istanbul, you're heading out to the airport and get blown away. So I want to start by saying, you know, all killings of innocent civilians, whether it's carried out by these non-state actors or by states, is wrong and illegal. And I think we need a serious discourse and a comprehensive approach to addressing this problem. Your guest from Beirut talked about the root causes that the international community has not really paid close attention to. So we've focused on a military solution to a problem that has nothing to do with military. This is a religious, an ethnic, a political, social, economic problem, and it goes back to centuries. So we may not be able to find an adequate solution to permanently end terrorism, but I think the international community has a responsibility to at least take a position on this as to, one, let's have a global definition of terrorism. Who is a terrorist? Because one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So even in the case of Turkey, where Turkey was facilitating the transfer of people from its territory into ISIS-controlled territory, these were not considered terrorists by the Turks. Even the response from Turkey in terms of the bombing in Istanbul is somewhat muted, in that the Turks have played it very calmly, not outrightly condemning anyone, initially assuming it was, you know, a fringe group from the PKK. But there's a broader issue here, whether it's in Turkey or it's in Iraq or in Bangladesh or Saudi Arabia. We simply cannot separate the domestic politics of some of these targeted countries and the response we see from these fringe groups. Some of them stems from hopelessness. Some of it stems from religion. Some of it stems from political corruption, political decay. And some of it has to do with history. I mean, this is the 100th anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement in the Middle East. Is there any discussion as to the responsibility or ownership of Europe in what is going on in the Middle East today or in North Africa? And we also see the British government release the Chilcot report today. Tony Blair has continued to deny the fact that he takes some of the should take ownership and the responsibility for the chaos that is going on in Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. So, and we simply have not learned, neither from Iraq or Syria, that the military solution is not a permanent solution to this kind of problem. As I said at the beginning, these are not military problems. These are problems that has to do with the human condition on the planet of the Earth and the global injustices perpetuated against people within all countries. So unless we begin to address this problem, we are not going to have innocent civilians being targeted or individuals who randomly decide to blow up people to make a political statement or religious statement.
Now, on our way to the phones here, Phyllis, and I want to get to the callers here and come back to Karim in the studio, but You know, I can hear people saying that what the four of you have outlined in many ways is the complexity of this issue. And even though Rami said there may have to be some form of police action, I think were his words, I can hear people saying, okay, we understand the roots of this. We understand the complexity of this. But societies cannot allow an Islamic State or any other group to continue to perpetrate and carry out these mass killings of innocent people, whether it's in Dhaka or whether it's in Baghdad or whether it's in Brussels or wherever that is.
Right. What I think is the hard thing for people to acknowledge is that there may not be a way to respond that's quick and that looks tough and is going to help. It is true, and I agree with Rami, there are moments for a moment when a police action, he actually said a police action or even military action locally and small scale, is needed. But we should be clear, for example, the time that led to the U.S. announcing, yes, we are going to war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria back in 2014, was because of the crisis on Mount Sinjar, when a group of Yazidis had been surrounded by ISIS, were facing a very dire consequence. No question about that. There was a need for a military response to that on the very short term. What we need to be clear about is that those people were not saved by U.S. bombing campaigns. They were saved by a relatively small number of Kurdish militia forces who managed to get up the mountain from the back, get them off the mountain, away from ISIS, and down to safety through back through Syria and then back into Iraq. And that's obviously not only legal, but it was legitimate, it was necessary, and it worked. The U.S. bombing campaign of those 3 days, only two sets of bombs were anywhere near Kirkuk, and that didn't particularly help. The other bombs were all up near Erbil, where the U.S. was afraid that ISIS might go to threaten the oil fields up there. I mean, we should be clear, the U.S. does not go to war for humanitarian purposes. It sometimes uses humanitarian reasons to sell a war, but they just don't do it. If they did, there would have been no killing of over 1.5 million people in the Congo if humanitarian concerns were the only thing. So we have to be a little bit cynical about motivations of states, not only our own, certainly our own, but also of Russia, certainly of Saudi Arabia, certainly of Turkey, of all of these countries. So I think the question is, what do we do? I don't think the answer is we sit back and do nothing and let ISIS either commit terrorist atrocities around the world or suppress and repress people in such horrific ways in territory that they control. We have to recognize that really working is going to take longer. So I said earlier, step one is do no harm. Step two, if we're serious about saying we have no boots on the ground, get them out. Withdraw the troops who are simply providing a new excuse for more opposition and more terrorism. Step three, stop flooding the region with arms. They all end up in the hands of extremists anyway. It makes things worse and not better. Step four, an easy one. We have a law in this country that says if you can meet somebody from ISIS or somebody from Al-Qaeda and provide them with training about what nonviolence tactics look like, you could spend 20 years in federal prison because that's a federal crime. It's considered aiding terrorism. We should reverse that law. That should be, here in the U.S., that should be an easy one. Step five, we need new kinds of new diplomacy that are focusing on building, the U.S. needs to be building a diplomatic partnership, not a military partnership. We don't need to get Russia coming in to bomb more in Syria, killing more civilians, even than the U.S., and the U.S. is killing plenty of civilians. We need to stop that and get the partnership based on real diplomacy. We need to support the U.N.'s effort for small-scale diplomacy leading up to bigger diplomacy. None of that's going to be quick. None of that plays out on television and looks strong. But it's what's going to work. It's what has a chance to work. We need more pressure on the economy here. The U.S. version is we're going to keep ISIS from getting money by bombing safes full of money and bombing their small-scale oil infrastructure. The problem is that destroys the environment, kills civilians. What would be better is if we started putting enough pressure on the Saudis, for instance, to crack down on their own population who are massively funding ISIS. That's widely known. It isn't so clear whether it comes from the government, from the royal family, from independent Saudi institutions, from individual Saudis. But we do know that the Saudi government has the capacity, it has enough control of its own population to stop it. And if the U.S. said, you know what, we're not going to sell you any more of those billion-dollar arms deals until you prevent the sending of money to ISIS, I think we'd see some kind of massive shift. And at the same time, we need to be putting huge amounts more money into providing for refugees and displaced people in Syria and around the region. All of these are long-term things that are not going to have results right away, but they have a chance of changing the conditions. And then at the end of the day, we need to take responsibility for the government that we've put in power in Syria, in Iraq in particular, a government that is so corrupt, sectarian, and incompetent that people would rather turn to ISIS than turn to their own government. That's the government we continue to support, to provide political backing, to provide billions of dollars in financial support, and crucially, we provide all their arms. If we stopped doing all that, that government would be very weak, yes, and another government might emerge that had some legitimate support from its own population. Those are the long-term kinds of things that we need to be doing, not continuing to do the same thing militarily, which is having such a dramatically opposite impact as what we say is the purpose.
So I just want to know who is buying the $2.3 billion worth of oil that ISIS has been trolling these last few years, because clearly that money is coming from someplace.
Well, a lot of it was going to Turkey. A lot of that oil was going to Turkey. Some of it is being transferred from illegal vessels to legitimate vessels on the high seas and going undetected and may end up anywhere in the world. The oil market is very fluid, and hence export of oils. No one knows precisely their place of origin. But I want to go back to what, is it Phyllis?
Phyllis Bennis.
Yeah, just said. I think the Obama administration, unlike the Bush administration, has taken an approach that, you know, in some way may not be appreciated by all, but leading from behind. I don't think having U.S. Forces or boots on the ground is really solving the problem. It may exacerbate the situation. So I think what the Obama administration has tried to do in as difficult and complicated a situation as ISIS-controlled territories in both Iraq and Syria is to provide logistics and intelligence to forces on the ground. In fact, this is part of the problem between the United States and Turkey right now, that the U.S. is supporting the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmergas, who were in some way aligned with the PKK, and the elements within both Syria, Kurdish Syrians, and Kurds from Turkey who have taken refuge in the autonomous region, who directly oppose to the policies of the Turkish government in Kurdish control region. So there is it's a lot more complicated than meet the eyes, and I think the Obama administration and others are having an extremely difficult time of how you navigate between these various groups. But I have to say, even cutting off arms supplies to Saudi Arabia or to the Iraqi regime, Saudi Arabia buys a lot of its weapons from Britain and not really from the United States. I mean, they realize that the Congress has been putting a lot of pressure on the Saudi government to turn down some of its extremist position and support an extremist group. And even there's a legislation going through the Congress that would allow families of victims of 9/11 to sue the Saudi Arabian government. Mm-hmm. The Saudis have threatened to withdraw their $750 billion in U.S. bonds. I mean, it's a threat. I don't know how credible, because there's no other place to put the $750 billion. Yeah. But in any event, I think Iraq really will never be a full-fledged sovereign state again. And Vice President Biden when he was in the Senate, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he saw the solution for Iraq as dividing Iraq between the three separate groups, a Shiite South, a Middle Belt Sunni, and the North Kurdish. The Shiites and the Sunnis are never going to reconcile, given the political history of Iraq and the problems that were created by the U.S.-British invasion. So if we're looking to create a unified state in Iraq, a la Saddam Hussein period, it's not going to happen. What do you do with Iraq? I'm not sure. Syria is the same. Libya is the same. Somalia, many of these countries are not going to be unified sovereign states anymore on the Westphalian tradition.
We're in the 100th anniversary of Sykes-Picot, which yes. created nations that never existed before.
Exactly.
The other part, though, I just throw this out and turning here to Karim, is my friends in Baghdad have always said to me the same thing my friends in Sarajevo said before things fell apart in that region in the Balkans, which was 80% of the Muslim marriages in Baghdad were between Sunni and Shia.
Correct.
Just like 80% of the marriages in 70% of the marriages in
Yugoslavia
in Sarajevo mm-hmm. were between Christians and Muslims.
That's right.
There's a cosmopolitanness that was created, and it was created in part under the dictatorships, which is all part of the contradictions that we have a hard time with.
It's like the most simple thing of like, I'm not going to listen to what somebody or a dictator is trying to say. I mean, Phyllis and Max have both said extremely poignant and correct points. I think that we have to also remember that there is only one group of people that are happy with what is going on in the world at the moment, and that's arms companies, right? They're the one group of people who are like jumping around having champagne dinners, you know, because for example, when Britain decided to bomb Syria and bomb ISIS, however long ago it was, 6 months or something, the week before that, all the people that voted for the bombing were at a champagne reception by the arms, hosted by arms companies. Now, the campaign against the arms trade are going after these countries and these organizations that are literally in Western countries building bombs and funding companies that are then going to continue to use illegal bombs. For example, the Saudi Arabian bombs in Yemen, right? Group I'm associated with in London are now taking the British government to court over the building of the manufacture of those weapons and the supply of those to Saudi Arabia. Turkey, the complex relationship that Turkey has with this is that you have a right-wing leaning government who are holding Europe to ransom with refugees, who are letting all the ISIS fighters go in and out, with no problem. Like maybe they know where they are, but they're not that bothered, right? They've never had a great relationship with Assad. They're going to let it continue, but then at the same time, ISIS bombed Turkey, right? And then you've got Saudi Arabia, all the funding that goes through to ISIS. I mean. And again, I was saying about where I'm from and people go to fight for ISIS. If you've got a kid who's on benefits, say he gets to 25, 26, he doesn't have a career, he's been a bit of a playboy, you know, he hasn't got any direction. And then someone goes to him afterwards, like, you know, you can go get $2,000 a month and you get to hold a gun and you get to go and fight for something. You get to go and fight for your people, whatever your people is. That money comes from somewhere. A lot of that is from the Saudi Arabian government, Saudi donors. And then Saudi gets bombed. At the end of Ramadan, before Eid, there is literally no rationale behind ISIS in terms of an ideology. There's two things with ISIS. You're either trying to fight them with territory, or you're trying to fight them with in the diaspora in the ideology. If you're talking territory, it's all about arms and the funding. How do you tackle the ideology? It's everything that Phyllis and Max were talking about in terms of the discourse, the establishment of a society where people do not feel disenfranchised. And as Phyllis said, we're talking a long, long time before that happens. And as Max said, will we ever see in Iraq the way that it was post Sykes-Picot? The only thing I disagree with Max is with what Max said is it's not a result of a military intervention. Depending on how you term or classify military intervention, the Middle East has been occupied for 500, 600 years. by different people, and it's a military intervention. Sykes-Picot is a military division. You know, Sykes-Picot was a very carefully, well, it wasn't that carefully planned because it didn't work, but it was a very divisive element based already on ethnic and religious grounds. So we know that that doesn't work. So for the Biden idea of the Shia South, the Sunni belt, the Kurd North, they tried to do that with Lebanon. They tried to make Lebanon the Christian enclave that would be above the Jewish state, right? Not realizing that the Sunnis in Lebanon were having children a lot more regularly and having more kids than the Christians were. So within 5 years, it was a Sunni Muslim dominated country. Same with Syria. Like, Syria is a mix of so many different groups of people. And Iraq is well known for that idea of Shia and Sunni parents. That's why, actually, the Shia-Sunni conflict that goes back, okay, there was a war and there was a killing, and certain people believe that, but it has not led to this sort of division now. This is the most classic example of divide and conquer. You know, the idea that the from the Sunni side that the Shia is a disbeliever, you know, and then the Shia side believing that the Sunni is not a real Muslim. Mm-hmm. Okay, that didn't exist
right.
Before.
And I'm going to open the phones to get at least one call in here. To apologize to my callers. Let me get somebody in here and then come right back to our guests to conclude this. And I think that there is something to explore at some point, which is people, friends and colleagues from Kabul, Iraq, from Baghdad, Damascus, other places. I mean, these were places that were cosmopolitan, thousands of years old, that had developed a different way of thinking about gender issues, about equality, about what it means to be Muslim, that is completely overshadowed by the madness that we've seen the world engulfed in. And I think that's something that we really forget. And want to define things in a very kind of simplistic, linear way. But let's get a phone call in here, 410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. Everything your guest is just wonderful information to know. My question is, with the ISIS, because ISIS seems similar to the gangs in the United States. You know, you go back further. You know, you have a lot of young people who are disenfranchised, and I think one of your guests talked about that. And when you have disenfranchised youth, they can easily be misled into joining a group that makes them feel that they're wanted. My question is, with all the long-term problems of having with ISIS and all these radical groups, what is the long-term mental health impact on young people, including the children who are going to be the next new generation of maybe a possible future ISIS or whatever? How is the overall world community dealing with the mental health issues that's going to afflict the young babies who are seeing this happen, including the teenagers? And I'll hang up on this.
That is really a really interesting question. We only have like 8 minutes or so before the end of the hour, but I think that's really important.
It's an extremely important point you raised, Mac. We have the United Nations released a report last week saying 65 million people were internally displaced or were refugees, and over 100,000 of these people were children. I think what we have seen in since the end of the post-Cold War and the many internal conflicts that have taken place, the majority of victims are women and children. And some of the perpetrators, particularly in Liberia, in Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Sierra Leone, were all carried out by children. I was in Angola, visited some of the orphanages in Angola in the immediate aftermath of a 27-year armed conflict. Most of these children grew up in an environment of violence. They are illiterate, they have no future, no skills, and hence, what are the alternatives for these kids? Putting them in an orphanage or providing the kinds of care, mental health care they need, put them in a regime that they're not really used to. So they see it like a regime that is similar to a prison, and there's a high rate of recidivism, a high rate of escape, because the world of these children growing up in that kind of environment is not going to be good for the Middle East or the world in general.
I think that's something that we do not that does not take part in this conversation very often. When we think about the effect on populations and the children.
The simple answer is that they're not doing anything about the mental health. I think it's a simple answer. There is no funding. There's funding for bombs. There's funding for everything else, but there is no funding to look after the people. Okay, so for example, you build a shanty town in Jordan, right? You're not looking after the children. We are literally going back in time. We're going back hundreds of years in a matter of six months in a time. You're having generations of kids who are 10 years old who have never been to school. They're emotionally stunted. They haven't had interaction. They haven't had education. Not even education. Not just with literacy and being able to read and write. They haven't had any sort of education other than how do I look after my family? How do I hustle for money? And it goes back to exactly what your caller said about gangs.
So, Phyllis, I heard you trying to come in, and we had like 3 minutes left, but I want to get you in here.
Yeah, just very quickly, something that Kareem just said I think is crucial about there's always money for bombs and there's not money to take care of people. If we look at what happened just this last week in Fallujah, great cheers about the so-called liberation of Fallujah. Tens of thousands, I think it's something like 40,000 people who escaped at the last moment, who were able to get out for the first time, out from under the siege that the Iraqi government had placed on Fallujah, and out from under the armed violence of ISIS, fled into the desert and found nothing. Not a tent camp, not water, not food, not medical care. The temperatures were over 110 degrees every day, and this is about 25% children. And it's an appalling reality that we heard about for one day and then we stopped hearing about it. People can't get to these areas. They're not even camps. They have not, because the government had not allowed them to get close enough to establish camps. Médecins Sans Frontières had been in 2 weeks earlier with one set of food trucks that had enough food for 2 weeks. This was 3 weeks before, so there was no food, there was no water available, and people were simply going to die of dehydration and starvation. Hmm. And these included the children. So this question of looking at it solely from the geopolitical side and how do we prevent terrorist attacks on the West, as if that's the only question, without looking at how do we prevent the deaths of children because of these wars, not because of a terrorist attack, because of the wars against terror, that means that we have failed as a world, as a society, as a planet, and certainly this country, with 28% of all the wealth of the world, by far the most wealthy and most powerful country that has ever existed. It is a huge shame for us.
So this has been a fascinating conversation, as usual. I really appreciate the time my guests have taken here. Rami Khoury, who joined us earlier from Lebanon, and the work he does, we'll be linking to his work, as we will to Phyllis Bennis's work, Director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Dr. Max Hilaire, Chair of the Political Science Department here at Morgan State University, and visiting us from Britain here in the studio, Kareem Samara, British-Palestinian musician and founding member of Artists for Palestine UK and London Palestine Action. And in this country, he collaborates with Baltimore's Ryan Harvey, blending American and Arab protest music, and is working on his own loop of exploration of music and oud and percussion, and joins us here. Thank the four of you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a very important conversation, and I thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a short break, and we're actually going to come back and honor somebody who's been working here for 20 years in the streets of Baltimore. And we, you know, as someone said to me, in many ways, we have here in certain communities in Baltimore the same kind of problem that people are ignoring with our children and what happens when you grow up in a culture of violence. We were talking to some men who've been working diligently for the last 20 years to ameliorate that and to make people understand what the reality is. Stay with us. We'll be right back.